From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week came the announcement that Michael Powell, lightning rod chairman of the Federal Communications Commission for the past 4 years, would be leaving the FCC. Bob takes a look back at his stormy tenure.
Well, the do not call list was wildly popular. In teaming up with the Federal Trade Commission to crack down on telemarketers, FCC Chairman Michael Powell can look back to at least one chapter of his leadership not clouded by controversy, ideology, and widespread outrage. On his watch, the FCC also mandated fully digital TV broadcasts by 2007, allowed consumers to easily switch mobile phone carriers without changing phone numbers, and made it easier for blind people to enjoy TV programs via a special narration soundtrack. Otherwise, he will be remembered chiefly for two things. The first is content regulation in the form of fines against local and national broadcasters for on-air indecency. His most notorious target, radio host Howard Stern, self-described martyr to free speech.
What's the name of Mel Gibson's movie?
The Passion of the Christ.
The Passion of the Stern. Special appearance by Yucko the Clown. Something like that. Michael Powell as Pontius Pilate.
Some believe the FCC has a mandate to keep public airwaves free of indecent content, that it has to draw the line somewhere, say at Janet Jackson's exposed nipple. Others see the fines as a clear case of government censorship. Stern, they said, was a sacrificial lamb, an offering to the red states to prove the Bush White House was safeguarding their family values. Then came fines to the Clear Channel stations carrying Shock Jock Bubba the Love Sponge, CBS for the infamous Super Bowl wardrobe malfunction, and most recently to Fox Broadcasting for a raunchy bachelor party sequence in the reality show Married by America. This has had its effect. Broadcasters from coast to coast, NPR included, are cowering in fear of what joke or casual remark might result in an onerous fine. As it turned out, Stern and company were not the last lambs led to slaughter, but more on that later. First, the other historical aspect of the Michael Powell regime, not the de facto regulation of content, but the deregulation of ownership. In June 2003, the Powell FCC changed rules to allow such gargantuan media companies as Viacom, Clear Channel, and Rupert Murdoch's News Corp to own more stations and command more audience than ever before. Here's Powell in 2003 on PBS's NewsHour.
You know, we've heard this statistic over and over in this debate that five companies control everything, own everything, monopolize everything. Those are real poor uses of words, because they actually own only about 25% of all the channels, but they happen to command 80% of the viewership.
Such rationalizations for deregulation led to accusations that Powell was a handmaiden to the media oligarchs. In his rare public statements, Powell himself claimed to be a defender of consumer choice. Either way, he was a loyal and surprisingly visible agent for President Bush's laissez-faire philosophy. But who would have guessed that in service of a cause as arcane as media consolidation, hitherto the subject matter of academics, public interest Cassandras, and inside the Beltway policy wonks, Powell would run into such a buzzsaw. When the rule changes on ownership caps were announced, the chairman was sawed right into, from 750,000 irate private citizens to unexpected quarters on the political right. Key congressional Republicans bridled, and no less a personage than New York Times columnist William Safire called the move a power grab by big media, the most controversial decision in FCC history. Safire should have seen it coming. One of Powell's first acts as chairman was to approve 62 pending radio station acquisitions to now gigantic station combines Clear Channel and Cumulus Media. In 2002, the commission killed provisions requiring broadband providers to lease their cable and fiber lines, built out under monopoly protections, to other providers. And in the run-up to the infamous TV ownership rule change itself, Powell was accused of attempting to stifle debate. Democratic FCC Commissioner Michael J. Copps was so frustrated, He was forced to schedule his own public hearings.
I think there's a feeling amongst some at the commission that if you do a few econometric studies and a few professional studies, that you can proceed and base your decision on that, and that going out into specific media markets does not add a lot to the public record. I disagree vehemently with that.
Powell did not attend those hearings, but many citizens did. And when the rule changes were finally promulgated 6 months later, so many citizens emailed in protest that they crashed the FCC's server. This led to a frenzy on Capitol Hill, where the Republican-controlled House voted 400-21 to block the rule's implementation. A federal court then overturned the rule as beyond the commission's statutory authority. Media companies have filed an appeal with the Supreme Court, which has yet to decide on whether it will consider the case. And therein the great irony of Michael Powell's tenure. His departure was announced 1 week ago. 6 days later, the White House acknowledged that it will not defend the FCC's proposed rule before the High Court, dramatically diminishing the likelihood that the case will be reviewed. Probably the most pivotal ruling on media consolidation was in the court of public opinion, an angry throng crying for blood. Bush remains in the White House, Rupert Murdoch is still rich, and Michael Powell?
On Wednesday, reporter Carl Cameron attended his first presidential press conference in his new role as Fox News Channel's White House correspondent.
Carl, welcome to the beat. Is everybody thrilled Carl is here?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Please express a little more enthusiasm for him.
A question on Social Security, if we may, sir.
If his mere presence pleased the president, Mr. Cameron's first question at his first press conference probably pleased him more.
Those who opt into a potential private account, personal account, could in fact have a guaranteed benefit as well.
Notice the quick semantic substitution, the word personal for private. The administration advocates a plan that, among other things, allows young people to divert a third or more of their payroll taxes into what it now calls personal investment accounts. The president used to call that privatization, but it seems that word has negative connotations, so he doesn't use it anymore. Democrats, not surprisingly, assert that these are private investment accounts and that the administration is, in fact, attempting to privatize Social Security.
Michael Tanner is director of the Social Security Project at the Libertarian Cato Institute. He's been involved in designing the proposed changes both to the system and to the language. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You've been working on this issue for many years now, and were actually quite instrumental in launching Cato's program 10 years ago that in turn became the blueprint, or a substantial part of the blueprint, for the Bush plan. What was that project called?
Well, when we began the project, it was the Project on Social Security Privatization. A few years ago, we changed that title to the Project on Social Security Choice.
Well, so why?
We did focus groups and talked to people. We found that people, by and large, didn't understand the term privatization. Their first thoughts was it was like privatizing the bus lines. We were going to hire a private company to send out the checks. And then their second thought was that it meant abandoning any sort of safety net or government regulation or oversight of the program. Since neither of those were true, we thought it was better to try and come up with another term that we could use in describing the program.
Is the GOP as enthusiastically embracing choice as the Libertarian Cato Institute is?
I haven't seen Republicans in Congress calling this Social Security choice. I've seen a lot of different terms tried, modernization, personalization. Haven't seen any single term that works very well.
In some ways, is the whole nomenclature surrounding this issue made more difficult by the very term Social Security, which is quite clear, quite definitive. It is supposed to be a social contract promising retirement security for all Americans.
Go back even more sort of Orwellian to the Federal Insurance Contribution Act, which is what your Social Security taxes are called. They're certainly not a contribution. They're a tax. And it's not really insurance in any sense of the word. In fact, the Supreme Court's ruled it's not insurance. It is simply a tax and a government spending program. So from the very beginning, the whole Social Security debate has been caught up in the use of language for various purposes.
Let me change the subject briefly to political correctness. I think most everybody agrees, most everybody, that political correctness is a sort of tyranny of the left. You can no longer call a thing by its name for fear that some constituency somewhere might be offended. Now let me read from a memo promulgated by the National Republican Congressional Committee. It said, "It is very important that we not allow reporters to shill for Democrat demagoguery by inaccurately characterizing personal accounts and privatization as one in the same." My question is, isn't this exactly the same crime as is committed by the political correctness police to try to flog in a political agenda through the use of language?
Well, I think it reflects a similar obsession with language rather than substance. What we should be talking about is the importance of Social Security reform and what individual accounts are all about. And I will agree that certain Republican members of Congress get much too obsessed about the language used. On the other hand, I think there's a point that privatization, having become a pejorative, carries certain connotations with it when the questions are asked using it.
Isn't it just the proper use of language? The red flags that the word privatization raises in people's minds are precisely the red flags that opponents to the project on Social Security choice are themselves warning against, namely that the government's security that you've always had since the days of the New Deal would dramatically diminish under the president's plan.
Well, they're not talking about simply abolishing the program. They're talking about creating an investment component within the existing Social Security framework. I think that because it raises red flags, it's something that opponents of individual accounts certainly are going to use, and you see opponents saying don't privatize Social Security fairly regularly.
I want to ask you the same question that we asked the liberal linguist George Lakoff just a couple of weeks ago. When dealing with any moral issue, and most political issues one way or another turn on various notions of morality, is there such thing as neutral language that, let's say, a journalist can use? Or is just word choice, in effect, choosing sides?
I think it is certainly possible to use language that is simply pejorative or is simply inaccurate. And I think that you should strive to find neutral terms like individual accounts, something of that nature. But I think a journalist who uses privatization is not necessarily crossing the bounds. You know, people use privatization on me all the time. I don't care.
Some of my best friends say privatization.
That's it.
Mike, thanks very much.
Anytime.
Michael Tanner is Director of Health and Welfare Studies at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C.
Coming up, the secrets behind the journalists who tell secrets revealed.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last Sunday, The Washington Post exposed extremely secret Pentagon operations in a story on the front page. I'll read you the lead. The Pentagon, expanding into the CIA's historic bailiwick, has created a new espionage arm and is reinterpreting U.S. law to give Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld broad authority over clandestine operations abroad, according to interviews with participants and documents obtained by The Washington Post. The story about the Pentagon's secret incursions on CIA turf is largely based on anonymous sources and secret documents. Barton Gellman wrote the piece, and he joins me now to discuss the delicate process whereby government secrets wind up on page one. Barton, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Does the Post have some protocols for dealing in sensitive intelligence issues with the actual agencies involved?
Oh, sure we do. We never publish sensitive or classified information without having discussed it pretty extensively with the relevant U.S. government authorities. And they had actually weeks of notice, quite detailed, in writing, of what I had learned, what I was considering publishing, and what I was probably not going to publish.
Do you negotiate with them?
We don't explicitly say, is there any of this that you'd like to ask us to withhold? But by letting them know that we have it, we are, I think, implicitly opening the door to that conversation. And it does happen sometimes. They'll say, we'd really rather you didn't publish something. And we'll say, well, why? Can you let us understand better the interest involved here? Is there a future or ongoing operation that would be compromised? Is there a risk of revealing the identity of someone who could be put in danger, and so on? And we'll often have those conversations quite frankly. since 9/11, since I've been doing national security projects, I've withheld something for one reason or another that I knew to be true from the paper many times, I'd say more than a dozen times.
I noticed as I read your story, almost nobody was identified by name. I even noticed in a background briefing that the Defense Department gave, the transcript on Pentagon letterhead does not list the names of the people who are being transcribed. I mean, it was just astonishing to me how formalized is this system of protecting official sources going about their official duties in public. How necessary is it that the people you name remain anonymous?
Well, I think I'd have to take issue with your premise on this particular story. This story has three of the most responsible officials for the program I'm describing quoted on the record. Now, there's something to what you say more generally. Number one, I can't get people who are not authorized to tell me sensitive secrets and also have their names put out in public. It just can't be done. But that's one reason why I worked so hard to get documentary evidence in this story. And I quote pretty extensively from written materials that are internal to DOD to demonstrate that we do know what we're talking about in the story. What you're talking about with the background briefings is very true and disturbing and predates this administration by several administrations. Now, I wasn't at that briefing, and I do know who gave it, and I'm tempted to say, because I think the whole system is preposterous, but I suppose by some sort of implicit bargain with my newspaper, I'm precluded from doing that.
One of the advantages of anonymous sources is they enable you to get access to information and print stuff that you otherwise never would have gotten your arms around. On the other hand, it kind of can leave you out there hanging if some aspect of the story comes into question. Your piece in the Sunday Washington Post broadly suggested that the CIA was being frozen out of its central mission and intelligence gathering, particularly in war zones. If you were dealing with the intelligence apparatus in order to fact-check your story, did you feel blindsided when all of a sudden CIA came back with, oh, no, we know all about this program, and oh, by the way, we're all working together, ebony and ivory, tra-la-la-la-la. Do you feel like you've been suckered?
No, I really, really don't feel like I've been suckered. What the CIA and Defense Department are saying about their cooperation and everyone working together is generic and broad and spin. There hasn't been any dispute of any fact in the story, period.
When you approach the DOD with the story originally, it's not as though they rushed to assist you in its preparation, is it?
No, I asked for interviews beginning in the summer on this subject, and I got either sort of no reply or no thank you or we'll see that lasted for months. This is not uncommon. The kinds of stories I do are usually about things that they don't discuss in public, and so it's a little bit like borrowing money from the bank. You have to have some to get some. And if you just say, would you kindly sit down and talk to me about your secret programs? The answer is no, thank you. If you say, well, here's everything I've learned, and I'd really like to make sure I understand it right and see what you have to say about it, you have a better chance, though by no means a certain chance, of getting their attention.
Okay. Barton, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Barton Gellman is a national correspondent for The Washington Post.
So, at the Washington Post, there is an established process to determine when and how to tell a secret without endangering national security. But what about the lone wolves, like William Arkin? In his new book called Code Names, Arkin discloses and explains some 3,000 military code names, many of them still classified. These are secret names for secret plans and programs related to weapons agreements with foreign nations, undercover counterinsurgency units, or when and how to use American troops on American soil. In his introduction, Arkin writes, "For many, the immediate reaction to this compendium will be anger. You're exposing secrets and endangering America." So, Bill, let's start there. Who died and left you in charge of deciding what's safe and not safe to say?
Well, I think the Constitution did first. I'm an expert on the military and a long-standing defense analyst. It seemed to me after 9/11 that not only was there an explosion of secrecy, but the impact of secrecy was made more clear, whether it be in the events of 9/11 itself and the inability of government agencies to talk to each other because of their hoarding of information, whether it was the weapons of mass destruction debate in Iraq or the exclusion of many people from the war planning process in Iraq, even internally, secrecy increased. It had an impact on our national security in a very negative way. And since I was in a position to sort of decipher this area, I felt that it would be a little bit duplicitous if I hoarded all of that information when I was basically arguing that the government should be putting it out. I felt like I had to put it out as well. It was a risk, but it was one that I think was worth taking. And I've had great advice and counsel from retired generals, admirals, others.
And in your introduction, you list all the wrong reasons that governments keep secrets. Secrecy, you say, is used to protect an inflated project budget, to avoid bureaucratic battles, to avoid debate and oversight. Am I missing anything?
Sometimes it's used just to hide the politically sensitive from the American public. Nuclear war preparations, repugnant weapons such as microwave or laser weapons, controversial activities such as torture or domestic intelligence. Secrecy essentially to avoid having to debate what it is that we are doing in the name of the American people is the worst type of secrecy. And that is the one that has been growing the most since 9/11.
Look, you maintain a one-of-a-kind filing cabinet with, it must be, thousands of secret documents, and you appear to have emptied virtually all of them into this book. Are you sure, really sure, that you should have let all those cats out of the bag, even the range and magnitude of American nuclear activities?
I am sure. I feel confident after having had the book vetted by knowledgeable former military people, by people on the inside, by legal counsel, some of whom have asked me to make changes to soften the description. I am sure, and I await the government to dispute that. If the Justice Department or the Defense Department believes that I've compromised U.S. national security, I imagine they'll take legal action. I don't see any move in that direction. The truth of the matter is these are mostly mundane and trivial secrets kept for the wrong reasons. And in the history of secrecy, what we have learned is that the more that's secret, the less that's secret, because the real secrets can't be protected within this arcane and Byzantine structure.
And do you really believe that the publication of code names will actually lead to less secrecy within government, especially within the Bush administration?
Well, I think it will lead to less secrecy immediately because there are less secrets. They're now in the public domain. So ipso facto, it's less secrecy. A perfect example was the New York Times story on Sunday about Power Geyser. Power Geyser was one of the code names that I discovered that had to do with the top secret contingency plan for the use of Delta Force in support of a disaster during their inaugural. If there had been a nuclear attack, Power Geyser would have been implemented and Delta Force would have been used to protect the presidency and the succession to the presidency. The Defense Department vociferously argued with the New York Times, don't publish the code name, don't publish information about this. And the Times came back to me and said, well, what do you say? And I say, it's a perfect example of where they're arguing that something is classified. And now what we have to really ask the question about is, should it be classified? Should the existence of such a contingency plan without details about what they would do or how they would do it, should the existence of the contingency plans themselves be a secret? And I conclude no, and the New York Times concluded no. And the reality is that the Pentagon sort of acquiesced and basically said, we don't comment on classified programs. Now, potentially, there could at least be a discussion and a debate about the propriety of using the military for this type of domestic law enforcement function, because that should worry many Americans.
All right. Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Journalist and military analyst William Arkin is author of Code Names, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World.
On Monday, the American Civil Liberties Union released thousands of pages of Pentagon documents detailing serious abuse of Iraqis by their American captors. Not at Abu Ghraib, but at other out-of-the-way detention centers in Iraq. The allegations include severe beatings, forced sodomy, electric shocks, cigarette burns, and murder, and in some cases are backed up by sworn testimony from civilian contractors. The Army says it has aggressively investigated all credible abuse allegations, but the documents suggest otherwise, and the ACLU charges the Pentagon with turning a blind eye or worse.
Agree or disagree, you have to give the group credit for uncovering the records. It wasn't easy. The ACLU first filed a Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, requests for the records well over a year ago, and finally had to go to court to get them released. Now the story is getting some coverage in newspapers, if not TV, and that prompted Eric Umansky, who surveys the papers for Slate, to observe that, quote, over the past month, the biggest scoops in the news business have come from an organization that's not in the news business. Eric joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So how was it that the ACLU managed to scoop big media on this story?
Well, unlike three of the four papers that I contacted, they actually filed a FOIA, which helps. And they also filed a FOIA long ago in the fall of 2003.
ACLU.
That's right, which is to say before the Abu Ghraib scandal broke.
Why didn't the media?
Well, I think the media didn't because it hadn't yet been codified as a sort of important story. But there were ample opportunities to file. In other words, there's a reason that the ACLU made a FOIA request back in the fall of 2003. There were reports, not completely confirmed, not photos, but well-documented reports about abuse, about beatings in Afghanistan. There was one piece in the Washington Post in December of 2002 that referred to different types of humiliation, keeping people naked. There was a sort of famous quote from an unnamed officer saying, if you're not violating prisoners' rights some of the time, you're not doing your job. What were the ramifications? Did it end up going on cable TV? Did it end up getting followed up? No, it was a one-day story.
So then you have those horrifying photos. Did that spur the media to action? Did they file their requests then?
I think it actually largely did spur them to action in a general sense. There was a lot more investigation of it. Now, did it spur the news organizations to file FOIA specifically? Mostly no. Some of the reporters and editors I spoke to said, wish we had done that. And some of the people I spoke to weren't so willing to kind of fall on their swords and pointed very strongly to the Bush administration's current recalcitrance towards FOIAs.
How does that express itself?
Well, the attitude of the Bush administration towards FOIAs is essentially, when in doubt, don't let it out. And that means you have to go down a long, potentially costly path in order for a FOIA to be successful, particularly when it comes to national security. There could be a delay involved, and then you might have to, you're likely, in fact, to go to a lawsuit. And a lawsuit costs a lot of money. You need to get your publisher involved. You need institutional backing.
Whereas if you're the ACLU, you got plenty of lawyers.
That's right. You got plenty of lawyers. That's your job, to go to court.
So along with the help of the courts, the ACLU did manage to get thousands of pages of internal records, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we have a clear understanding of what happened in those prisons.
Yeah, in fact, far from it. It's almost like kind of magnetic poetry. You have intense redactions, a lot of whiteout, basically. I came across, for example, one series of documents that was 4 pages long. It was a thread of emails, the subject head of which was Ray, potential torture of Iraqi detainees. The only thing that was not blacked out was that subject header.
All 4 pages were blank?
It was completely blank. There's one that also refers to FBI agents complaining about, quote unquote, a cover-up at Guantanamo Bay. Most other things in the document are blacked out. It's just impossible to figure out what that means.
So just a random phrase here and there does not a story make. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, here we have a heap of new documents. And for the Abu Ghraib scandal, we had a bunch of very powerful photographs. Most people get their news from television. You read the papers. How do you think the coverage has differed?
Yeah, I think it hasn't turned into the same sort of media storm as the Abu Ghraib scandal. You know, randomly redacted documents are not as evocative as photos of people on leashes. And the ACLU, frankly, has tried to be a little bit savvy in their PR strategy about it. Rather than taking, I don't know how many there are, say there were 5,000 documents and just sort of dumping them and saying, here you go, here's our big scoop. What they've done is they've released a portion at a time and each time kind of put a little narrative to it. you know, the latest time they've said our narrative now is that the Army investigations, which is what a lot of these documents come from, were incomplete and half-hearted. They could have said that about evidence from previous papers. They're focusing on it now because it's a new angle, frankly.
So what have been some of the previous angles?
The previous angles had to do with the sort of widespread nature of the abuse, special units, commando units being involved in abuse, things like that.
Is it at all comforting to you that with or without media attention, the documents show that it was the military itself, after all, that initiated investigations into what actually happened?
You know, frankly, it is sort of nice to see. What gives me pause is that because of the level of redactions here, because we're still not seeing all the documents, it's hard to paint a full picture. How many of the alleged abuses were there actually investigations of? How many of the investigations went to fruition, and what were the details of what happened and any court-martials therein? It's just hard to figure out that stuff.
Eric, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Umansky sums up what the major papers have to say each day in the Slate.com column, Today's Papers.
Coming up, what young people don't know about the internet, and a grown-up swallows a heaping helping of kid commercials.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of grant making. On the web at wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with some updates. After it was revealed that the government had paid columnist and talk show host Armstrong Williams nearly $250,000 to pitch the president's No Child Left Behind policy, Williams said he wasn't the only one. This week, two more columnists emerged with administration payola in their pockets. Maggie Gallagher, whose column appears in 75 newspapers, received more than $21,000 to promote the president's efforts to encourage marriage, except the same-sex kind, which he apparently was paid to oppose. And Michael McManus, whose ethics and religion column appears in 50 papers, also was paid to back the White House marriage initiative for a mere $10,000. Meanwhile, Senate Democrats have asked for a government investigation of Armstrong and Gallagher and are planning hearings of their own. On Wednesday, President Bush decried government payola, saying, quote, "All our cabinet secretaries must realize that we will not be paying, you know, commentators to advance our agenda. Our agenda ought to be able to stand on its own two feet."
And there's news on the pornography front. After a decade in which federal obscenity cases had dwindled to single digits, John Ashcroft vowed to stem the tide with a wave of prosecutions, and the Justice Department brought what it saw as a pivotal case against Rob Zicari and his wife Janet Romano of Extreme Associates, makers of such dirty movies as Cornhole Armageddon and Depravity in Deutschland. The company is based in North Hollywood, but since its movies are available nationwide on the net, it was indicted in Pittsburgh, where community standards are somewhat more rigid. They faced millions in fines and up to 50 years in prison. But last April, Zicari told us he was sure he'd be acquitted.
"I have confidence that a jury will say, listen, there's a difference between watching entertainment and feeling, hey, that's not my, you know, cup of tea. I could do without seeing that for the next 30 years of my life. And saying, you know what, the person who made that should go to prison."
On Thursday, Zicari was acquitted. U.S. District Judge Gary Lancaster, citing the 2003 Supreme Court ruling striking down Texas laws against sodomy, ruled that, quote, "the government could no longer rely on the advancement of a moral code, i.e., preventing consenting adults from entertaining lewd and lascivious thoughts, as a legitimate, let alone compelling, state interest." The prosecutor is considering an appeal.
It ain't fucking no more.
This week, a study by the Pew Internet and American Life Project found that only 1 in 6 users of internet search engines can tell the difference between, quote, unbiased search results and paid advertisements. Most people can tell the difference between, say, a television show and an infomercial, but digital information literacy and informed skepticism about the information the internet can provide is still far from universal. Deborah Fallows authored the Pew study and found that the people surveyed were far more confident in their dealings with internet information than they ought to be.
Internet users are by and large very happy with themselves. They have extreme confidence in themselves as users, as searchers. They're very trusting of search engines. About 70% of people say that they think search engines give them fair and unbiased results. But at the same time, we found that by and large, people were very unsophisticated with respect to how they used the search engines, what they were looking for, and being a judge of the results that they found on the search engine pages.
Is the paid material poorly marked on the website, or is it just that people don't really know what they're doing?
When we ask internet users what would help them identify the difference between paid results and the unpaid regular results, they tell us things like, well, let's label it, write paid results or sponsored results at the top. Put those paid results in a separate part of the page. Put them in a different color. Put them in a different font. And in fact, that's exactly what's going on with a lot of the big search engines already. With some search engines, it could be better displayed. But I think part of the responsibility comes with the internet user himself or herself. Most of us have not spent that much time on the internet. It's a very new medium. It's only about 10 years old. People just aren't that comfortable with what they're looking at on web pages yet.
In your survey, what's the average number of times a person uses a search engine a week?
This may come as a surprise to the most avid internet users out there, but the average user probably does a search 2 or 3 times a week. There's a hardcore who's searching every day and probably many times a day, and they will refute this information. But nonetheless, this is what the users tell us, that about 50% of people said that while they really love search engines, they could walk away from them tomorrow. They could go back to the old methods of looking for information like they used to, going to the library, going to the yellow pages, going to their bound maps.
What did the study tell you about who uses the internet search engines and why?
Men seem a bit more engaged with using search engines than women are. More men use search engines. They spend more time doing searches. They go online more frequently to do searches. Interestingly, there's kind of a dichotomy between confidence level and satisfaction. Men will tell you they're a lot more confident about themselves as internet searchers, but both men and women will say that they're quite satisfied with the kinds of results that they get. So it's a little puzzling where that great confidence in men comes from, because they seem to be behaving the same way and getting the same kind of satisfaction from it.
I noticed, and I guess this is one unsurprising result, that people aged 18 to 29 have a higher confidence when using search engines and use them more often. But are they better at it?
Certainly, they're more facile with their fingers. They IM, they email, they search, they watch TV, they talk on the phone, they do their homework simultaneously. But interestingly, I think there's a difference between this technological ease that they have and when they get a search result. What do they do with it? They seem to do the same thing that everybody does. They click on an answer, usually the top 2 or 3 results. They find something that pretty much matches what they're asking. They grab it, and they're satisfied with it. They don't seem to be any better. In fact, they seem to be a little bit worse at scrutinizing the information that they find on the internet and at being discerning about what they're looking for.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Deborah Fallows is a senior research fellow with the Pew Internet and American Life Project. This ability to sort through online information is being closely watched at universities, where internet research is eclipsing the library. So, if online sorting skills are crucial to academic success, I guess it's inevitable that the Educational Testing Service would devise a way to test them. Yep. ETS, the people who brought you the rank anxiety of the SAT and the GRE, are now offering a new exam, primarily for college sophomores, to measure digital information literacy. About 24 colleges will begin using the exam by the end of the month. Teresa Egan is managing the project for ETS, and she joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
In broad strokes, first of all, describe what your test is trying to measure.
We're measuring the critical thinking skills that are related to information literacy in a technological environment. So it's the ability to access the information, but also to evaluate it and to integrate information from a number of areas across this 2-hour assessment.
I'm a reporter constantly going through search engines. I understand how to use and, or, and quotation marks in order to narrow my search. That is part of what the ETS test is designed to measure, right?
Yes.
But you also have in the test a requirement that the students figure out how to graph that information, you know, a series of wavy lines across a graph or a bar graph. Why is that necessary to measure the credibility of information you can find on the net?
This is not strictly an assessment of your skills with researching on the internet. That's one aspect, but we're also assessing other technological proficiencies, such as whether a student understands what type of data you would represent on the x-axis and the y-axis, and can you interpret a graphical display of data, which is really a critical skill at the academic level. Or even in the field, if you're in the workforce environment and you are expected to possibly present a sales report, being able to interpret a graphical display of data or to create one is a very important skill. And this was deemed important by the university representatives who helped us to develop the test for students at the junior and senior year of college.
Teresa, this is a thoroughly unfair question, but have you taken this test?
Yes, I have.
How'd you do?
Well, fortunately, I took the assessment before we had the scoring mechanism in place.
You cheated.
When you take the test, it becomes apparent, even without a score, what your strengths and weaknesses are. I recognized what was very easy for me on the test and where I needed to focus a little more effort.
Teresa Egan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Teresa Egan is the project manager for the ICT Literacy Assessment Exam created by the Educational Testing Service.
Put your two hands out for a digger smack.
Dig 'em.
Watch a bowl of beer like that. Kellogg's Sugar Smack.
Dig 'em.
Toast and wheat for a snacking good breakfast. Kellogg's Sugar Smack.
Dig 'em. Tulips.
Selling stuff to kids on TV is as old as, well, TV. But now the whole world is getting angry about it. Last week, the European Union threatened to crack down on junk food marketing to children unless the industry shapes up. Closer to home, the Centers for Disease Control are deep into a study on the impact of pitching sugary sweets to kids. On Tuesday, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the most recent class action obesity suit against McDonald's could proceed on the merit of the claim that misleading advertising to children may have damaged the health of the plaintiffs.
On Wednesday, the Wall Street Journal reported that the food people and the ad people have teamed up in a new lobbying group called the Alliance for American Advertising to defend what is being called a First Amendment right to advertise. The alliance, which includes General Mills, Kellogg, and Kraft, along with two major ad industry groups, aims to, quote, promote the industry's willingness to police itself. Kraft had already started by pledging to stop marketing its most unhealthy products, Kool-Aid and Oreos, among others, to the under-12 crowd.
To prepare for a recent article in Slate, Seth Stevenson got up early a few Saturdays ago and settled in for the morning cartoons. He'd read such recent books as Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood, and Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and Consumer Culture. He wanted to see if the ads were likely to generate the kind of greed and envy that led to schoolyard brawls and incessant nagging, as the authors claimed.
The books will say things like, you know, kids are bombarded now. There's so much more marketing going on to kids than there was, you know, 20 years ago. I don't think that's necessarily true. I remember watching cartoons, you know, every waking minute that I was home and could be in front of a television. And I think that's the same for kids now. What the books pointed out that perhaps I hadn't thought much of before is how much damage these ads were actually, you know, doing to me in my day, just as they're doing to kids now. Kids aren't able to tell the difference between the ads and the programs themselves. Kids under a certain age can't tell what persuasive intent is, that someone's trying to sell them something. They don't understand that concept. And, you know, our frontal cortexes aren't really fully developed until we're in our late teens or maybe even early 20s. It's possible that all this marketing that's going on to children really is changing parts of our personalities, changing our insecurities and our acquisitiveness. And so it made me take a look at that in myself and think, gosh, you know, would things have been different if we did have a ban on marketing to children? Perhaps there would be insecurities that I don't have, or perhaps I wouldn't want that new gadget quite so much.
But isn't the point exactly that because kids have sort of zero understanding of what an ad is, and because their threshold of desire is also zero, they basically want everything they see on TV, whether it's in the programming or in the advertising, that there is an ultimate neutralizer of the corruption of their consumer souls, and that's their parents, who need only either turn off the TV or just say, no. You want such and such a product? No. You want the pirate ship? No.
Yeah, I mean, that's the initial reaction a lot of people will have. It's the parents' job to stop kids from wanting this stuff or just telling the kids, sorry, you can't have it. When you read these books, you'll see they say, you know, parents are under assault from the marketers, and the parents' job at doing that has become harder and harder, and it's unfair to put all of that on the parents' shoulders. We should create some regulations that put a little of that burden on the marketers, too, and make parents' lives a little bit easier.
You mentioned that parents or any adult is seldom seen in these ads, and when they do show up, they're not portrayed in the most flattering light.
Yeah, they're almost never there. Usually it's just the kids doing their own thing. When the parents are there, they're either scolds that the kids ignore, or they're the subject of jokes. They're made to look ridiculous.
You also talked about subtle and not so subtle sexist and racist messages, which infuse a lot of the advertising.
You know, all the ads for Toys for Little Boys take place in the backyard outside.
How quick can you lift? How fast can you roll? How high can you fly? Flywheels! Flywheels, random launcher, each sold separately.
All the ads for Toys for Little Girls take place inside in, you know, beautiful pink little bedrooms. That's to be expected. Also, you know, in any ad that features a cast of multicultural kids, it's almost always the white boys who end up as the protagonists and spokesmen for the ad.
Eerily foresaging their later role as white men, holding the reins of power in the society. I want to ask you about how you ended your piece in Slate, because you noticed that in addition to the toys and the food products, there was another category of advertised product that you had not recalled seeing when you were watching cartoons as a kid.
That's right. It seemed to me like more than half the ads I saw weren't for toys or food at all. They were for media products. There were ads for the DVDs like Princess Diaries, and ads for video games and video game systems, and for movies like Lemony Snicket.
Shark Tale's on DVD February 8th. He's a player.
Yeah. Remember his name.
Oscar.
And he's swimming with sharks.
Dan, 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 dan. Gang tested.
I think it's not so much the toys they covet, it's the movies, it's the DVDs and the video games. And that made me wonder if we are raising a generation of media addicts, a bunch of little scopophiliacs who just sit there inert and are bombarded with all this media. To me, that was the thing that seemed genuinely different and the thing that perhaps we should concern ourselves with.
Disney's greatest hits. 40 magical songs on 2 CDs.
It would seem to me that on the face of it, a little kid hectoring mom, you know, agitating for a media product is better than nagging for sugared cereal or some other sort of junk food. Or is the stuff that you're seeing advertised really just media junk food?
Well, maybe it is better than the kid wanting a sugary cereal. But the question you might ask is whether it's better than the kid wanting a toy. That maybe might be more conducive to creativity than just sitting back and letting the Princess Diaries DVD wash over you.
All right. Well, Seth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seth Stevenson is a regular contributor to Slate.com.
Whoa.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Ann Kosseff, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Susanna Dillaplane and Angelo Bello. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media, produced by WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. Women's E-News, news every day on issues of particular concern to women and with women's perspectives on public policy, at womensenews.org. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.